spirits and white, red spirits and grey, mingle, 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 you that mingle may. Here's the blood of a bat. Put in that, oh, put in that. Here's Libbard's bane. Put in again, mingle, 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 you that mingle may. Then she sang her work song. 2 spoons of sherry, 3 ounces of yeast, 1/2 pound of unicorn, and God bless the feast. Shake them in the colander, bang them to a chop, simmer slightly, snip up nicely, jump, skip, hop. Knit 1, knot 1, purl 2 together, pip 1 and pop 1 and pluck the secret feather. Baste in a moderate oven, God bless our coven. Tra-la-la, 3 toads in a jar, tee-hee-hee, put in the frog's knee. Peep out of the lace curtain, there goes the top lady girl. She's up to no good, that's certain. Ooh, what a lovely baby, how nice it would go with gravy. Pinch the salt, here she pinched it very nastily. Turn the malt, here she began twiddling round widdershins in a vulgar way. With a hey, nonny, nonny, and I don't mean maybe. At the end of this song, Madam Mim took a sentimental turn and delivered herself of several hymns of a blasphemous nature and of a tender love lyric which she sang sotto voce with trills. It was, "My love is like a red, red rose. His tail is soft and tawny, and everywhere my lovely goes, I call him Nick or Horny." She vanished into the parlour to lay the table. Poor Kay was weeping in the corner of the end hutch, lying on his face and paying no attention to anything. Before Madam Mim had finally thrown him in, she had pinched him all over to see if he was fat. She had also slapped him to see, as the butchers put it, if he was hollow. On top of this, he did not in the least want to be eaten for Sunday dinner, and he was miserably furious with the wart for leading him into such a terrible doom on account of a mere arrow. He had forgotten that it was he who had insisted on entering the fatal cottage. The wart sat on his haunches, because the cage was too small for standing up, and examined his prison. The bars were of iron, and the gate was iron too. He shook all the bars, one after the other, but they were as firm as rock. There was an iron bowl for water, with no water in it, and some old straw in a corner for lying down. It was verminous.
"Our mistress," said the mangy old goat suddenly from the next pen, "is not very careful of her pets."
He spoke in a low voice, so that nobody could hear. But the carrion crow, which had been left on the chimney to spy on them, noticed that they were talking and moved nearer.
"Whisper," said the goat, "if you want to talk."
"Are you one of her familiars?" asked the wart suspiciously. The poor creature did not take offence at this and tried not to look hurt.
"No," he said, "I am not a familiar. I'm only a mangy old black goat, rather tattered, as you see, and kept for sacrifice."
"Will she eat you too?" asked the wart, rather tremblingly.
"Not she. I shall be too rank for her sweet tooth, you may be sure. No, she will use my blood for making patterns with on Valpurgis night." "It's quite a long way off, you know," continued the goat without self-pity. "For myself, I don't mind very much, for I am old. But look at that poor owl there, that she keeps merely for a sense of possession and generally forgets to feed. That makes my blood boil, that does. It wants to fly, to stretch its wings. At night it just runs round and round and round like a big rat. It gets so restless. Look, it has broken all its soft feathers. For me it doesn't matter, for I'm naturally of a sedentary disposition now that youth has flown. But I call that owl a rare shame. Something ought to be done about it."
The wart knew that he was probably going to be killed that night, the first to be released out of all that band.
but yet he could not help feeling touched at the great-heartedness of this goat. Itself, under sentence of death, it could afford to feel strongly about the owl. He wished he were as brave as this.
"If only I could get out," said the wart. "I know a magician who would soon settle her hash and rescue us."
The goat thought about this for some time, nodding its gentle old head with the great cairngorm eyes. Then it said,
"As a matter of fact, I know how to get you out, only I did not like to mention it before. Put your ear near the bars. I know how to get you out, but not your poor friend there who is crying. I didn't like to subject you to a temptation like that. You see, when she whispers to the lock, I have heard what she says, but only at the locks on either side of mine. When she gets a cage away, she is too soft to be heard. I know the words to release both you and me and the black cock here too, but not your young friend yonder."
"Why ever haven't you let yourself out before?" asked the wart, his heart beginning to bound.
"I can't speak them in human speech, you see," said the goat sadly. "And this poor mad boy here, the whittle, he can't speak them either."
"On, tell me then."
"You will be safe then, and so would I and the cock be too, if you stayed long enough to let us out. But would you be brave enough to stay, or would you run at once? And what about your friend and the whittle and the old owl?"
"I should run for Merlin at once," said the wart. "Oh, at once, and he would come back and kill this old witch in two twos, and then we should all be out."
The goat looked at him deeply, his tired old eyes seeming to ask their way kindly into the bottom of his heart.
"I shall tell you only the words for your own lock," said the goat at last. "The cock and I will stay here with your friend as hostages for your return."
"Oh, goat," whispered the wart, "you could have made me say the words to get you out first and then gone your way. Or you could have got the three of us out, starting with yourself to make sure, and left Kay to be eaten. But you are staying with Kay. Oh, goat, I will never forget you, and if I do not get back in time, I shall not be able to bear my life."
"We shall have to wait till dark. It will only be a few minutes now."
As the goat spoke, they could see Madam Mim lighting the oil lamp in the parlour. It had a pink glass shade with patterns on it. The crow, which could not see in the dark, came quietly closer, so that at least he ought to be able to hear.
"Goat," said the wart, in whose heart something strange and terrible had been going on in the dangerous twilight, "put your head closer still. Please, goat, I'm not trying to be better than you are, but I have a plan. I think it is I who had better stay as hostage, and you who had better go. You are black and will not be seen in the night. You have four legs and can run much faster than I. Let you go with a message for Merlin. I will whisper you out, and I will stay."
He was hardly able to say the last sentence, for he knew that Madam Mim might come for him at any moment now, and if she came before Merlin, it would be his death warrant. But he did say it, pushing the words out as if he were breathing against water, for he knew that if he himself were gone when Madam came for him, she would certainly eat Kay at once.
"Master," said the goat without further words,
and it put one leg out and laid its double-knobbed forehead on the ground in the salute which is given to royalty. Then it kissed his hand as a friend.
"Quick," said the wart, "give me one of your hoofs through the bars, and I will scratch a message on it with one of my arrows."
It was difficult to know what message to write on such a small space with such a clumsy implement. In the end, he just wrote K. He did not use his own name because he thought K more important and that they would come quicker for him.
"Do you know the way?" he asked.
"My grandam used to live at the castle."
"What are the words?"
"Mine," said the goat, "are rather upsetting."
"What are they?"
"Well," said the goat, "you must say, let good digestion wait on appetite."
"Oh, goat," said the wart in a broken voice, "how horrible! But run quickly, goat, and come back safely, goat. And, oh, goat, give me one more kiss for company before you go." The goat refused to kiss him. It gave him the emperor's salute of both feet and bounded away into the darkness as soon as he had said the words. Unfortunately, although he had whispered too carefully for the crow to hear their speech, the release words had had to be said rather loudly to reach the next door keyhole, and the door had creaked.
"Mother! Mother!" screamed the crow. "The rabbits are escaping!"
Instantly, Madam Mim was framed in the lighted doorway of the kitchen.
"What is it, my Grizzle?" she cried. "What ails us, my halcyon tit?"
"The rabbits are escaping!"
shrieked the crow again. The witch ran out, but too late to catch the goat or even to see him, and began examining the locks at once by the light of her fingers. She held these up in the air, and a blue flame burnt at the tip of each.
"One little boy safe," counted Madam Mim, "and sobbing for his dinner. Two little boys safe, and neither getting thinner. One mangy goat gone, and who cares a fiddle? For the owl and the cock are left, and the whittle in the middle." "Still," added Madam Mim, "it's a caution how he got out. A proper caution, that it is."
"He was whispering to the little boy," sneaked the crow. "Whispering for the last half hour together."
"Indeed," said the witch. "Whispering to the little dinner, hey? And much good may it do him. What about a sage stuffing, boy, hey? And what were you doing, my greedy guts, to let them carry on like that? No dinner for you, my little painted bird of paradise, so you may just flap off to any old tree and roost."
"Oh, mother," whined the crow, "I was only undoing of my duty."
"Flap off," cried Madam Mim, "flap off, and go broody if you like."
The poor crow hung its head and crept off to the other end of the roof, sneering to itself.
"Now, my juicy toothful," said the witch, turning to the wart and opening his door with the proper whisper of "enough is as good as a feast," "we think the cauldron simmers and the oven is moderate. How will my tender sucking pig enjoy a little popping lard instead of the clandestine whisper?"
The wart ran about in his cage as much as he could, and gave as much trouble as possible in being caught, in order to save even a little time for the coming of Merlin.
"Let go of me, you beast!" he cried. "Let go of me, you foul hag, or I'll bite your fingers!" "How the creature scratches," said Madam Mim. "Bless us, how he wriggles and kicks just for being a pagan's dinner."
"Don't you dare kill me!" cried the wart, now hanging by one leg. "Don't you dare lay a finger on me, or you'll be sorry for it."
"The lamb," said Madam Mim, "the partridge with a plump breast, how he does squeak. And then there's the cruel old custom," continued the witch, carrying him into the lamplight of the kitchen, where a new sheet was laid on the floor, "of plucking the poor chicken before it is dead. The feathers come out cleaner so.
Nobody could be so cruel as to do it nowadays, by nothing or by never. But of course a little boy doesn't feel any pain. Their clothes come off nicer if you take them off alive. And who would dream of roasting a little boy in his clothes to spoil the feast?
Murderous! Cried the wart. You'll rue this ere the night is out.
Cabling, said the witch. It's a shame to kill him, that it is. Look how his little downy hair stares in the lamplight, and how his poor eyes pop out of his head. Greedy Guts will be sorry to miss those eyes, so she will. Sometimes one could almost be a vegetarian when one has to do a deed like this.
The witch laid the wart over her lap, with his head between her knees, and carefully began to take his clothes off with a practised hand. He kicked and squirmed as much as he could, reckoning that every hindrance would put off the time when he would be actually knocked on the head, and thus increase the time in which the black goat could bring Merlin to his rescue. During this time, the witch sang her plucking song of...
Pull the feather with the skin, not against the grey, no. Pluck the soft one out from in, the great with might and main, no. Even if he wriggles, never heed his squiggles, for mercifully little boys are quite immune to pain, no.
She varied this song with the other kitchen song of the happy cook.
Soft skin for crackling, oh, my lovely duckling, the skewers go here and the strings go there, and such is my scrumptious suckling.
You will be sorry for this, cried the wart, even if you live to be a thousand.
He has spoken enough, said Madam Mim. It is time we knocked him on the napper. Hold him by the legs, and when up goes his head, clip him with the palm edge, and then he is dead.
The dreadful witch now lifted the wart into the air, and prepared to have her will of him. But at that very moment there was a fizzle of summer lightning without any crash, and in the nick of time Merlin was standing on the threshold.
Ha! Said Merlin. Now we shall see what a double first to Dom Daniel avails against the private education of my master Blaise.
Madam Mim put the wart down without looking at him, rose from her chair, and drew herself to her full magnificent height. Her glorious hair began to crackle, and sparks shot out of her flashing eyes. She and Merlin stood facing each other for fully 60 seconds without a word spoken, and then... Madam Mim swept a royal curtsy, and Merlin bowed a frigid bow. He stood aside to let her go first out of the doorway, and then followed her into the garden. It ought perhaps to be explained, before we go any further, that in those far-off days, when there was actually a college for witches and warlocks under the sea at Dom Daniel, and when all wizards were either black or white, there was a good deal of ill-feeling between the different creeds. Quarrels between white and black were settled ceremonially by means of duels. A wizard's duel was run like this. The two principals would stand opposite each other in some large space free from obstructions and await the signal to begin. When the signal was given, they were at liberty to turn themselves into things. It was rather like the game that can be played by two people with their fists. They say, 1, 2, 3, and at 3 they either stick out 2 fingers for scissors, or the flat palm for paper, or the clenched fist for stone. If your hand becomes paper when your opponent's becomes scissors, then he cuts you and wins. But if yours are turned into stone, his scissors are blunted and the win is yours. The object of the wizard in the duel was to turn himself into some kind of animal, vegetable, or mineral which would destroy the particular animal, vegetable, or mineral which had been selected by his opponent. Sometimes it went on for hours. Merlin had Archimedes for his second, Madam Mim had the gore crow for hers, while Hecate, who always had to be present at these affairs in order to keep them regular, sat on the top of a stepladder in the middle to umpire. She was a cold, shining, muscular lady, the colour of moonlight. Merlin and Madame Mim rolled up their sleeves, gave their surcoats to Hecate to hold, and the latter put on a celluloid eye shade to watch the battle. At the first gong, Madame Mim immediately turned herself into a dragon. It was the accepted opening move, and Merlin ought to have replied by being a thunderstorm or something like that. Instead, he caused a great deal of preliminary confusion by becoming a field mouse, which was quite invisible in the grass, and nibbled at Madame Mim's tail as she stared about in all directions for about 5 minutes before she noticed him. But when she did notice the nibbling, she was a furious cat in two flicks. Wart held his breath to see what the mouse would become next. He thought perhaps a tiger, which could kill the cat. But Merlin merely became another cat. He stood opposite her and made faces. This most irregular procedure put Madame Mim quite out of her stride, and it took her more than a minute to regain her bearings and become a dog. Even as she became it, Merlin was another dog, standing opposite her, of the same sort. "Oh, well played, sir!" cried the wart, beginning to see the plan. Madame Mim was furious. She felt herself out of her depth against these unusual stonewalling tactics, and experienced an internal struggle not to lose her temper. She knew that if she did lose it, she would lose her judgment, and the battle as well. She did some quick thinking. If, whenever she turned herself into a menacing animal, Merlin was merely going to turn into the same kind, the thing would become either a mere dogfight or stalemate. She had better alter her own tactics and give Merlin a surprise. At this moment, the gong went for the end of the first round. The combatants retired into their respective corners, and their seconds cooled them by flapping their wings, while Archimedes gave Merlin a little massage by nibbling with his beak. "Second round," commanded Hecate. "Seconds out of the ring. Time." Clang went the gong, and the two desperate wizards stood face to face. Madame Mim had gone on plotting during her rest. She had decided to try a new tack by leaving the offensive to Merlin, beginning by assuming a defensive shape herself. She turned into a spreading oak. Merlin stood baffled under the oak for a few seconds. Then he most cheekily, and as it turned out rashly, became a powdery little blue tit, which flew up and sat perkily on Madame Mim's branches. You could see the oak boiling with indignation for a moment, but then its rage became icy cold, and the poor little blue tit was sitting not on an oak, but on a snake. The snake's mouth was open, and the bird was actually perching on its jaws. The jaws clashed together, but only in the nick of time the bird whizzed off as a gnat into the safe air. Madame Mim had got it on the run, however, and the speed of the contest now became bewildering. The quicker the attacker could assume a form, the less time the fugitive had to think of a form which would elude it, and now the changes were as quick as thought. The gnat was scarcely in the air when the snake had turned into a toad, whose curious tongue, rooted at the front instead of the back of the jaw, was already unrolling in the flick which would snap it in. The gnat, flustered by the sore pursuit, was bounced into an offensive role, and the hard-pressed Merlin now stood before the toad in the shape of a mullern, which could attack it. But Madame Mim was in her element. The game was going according to the normal rules now, and in less than an eye's blink, the toad had turned into a peregrine falcon, which was diving at 250 miles an hour upon the heron's back. Poor Merlin, beginning to lose his nerve, turned wildly into an elephant. This move usually won a little breathing space, but Madame Mim, relentless, changed from the falcon into an orle on the instant. An orle was as much bigger than an elephant is larger than a sheep. It was a sort of horse with an elephant's trunk. Madame Mim raised this trunk into the air, gave a shriek like a railway engine, and rushed upon her panting foe. In a flick, Merlin had disappeared. "One," said Hecate. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. But before the fatal 10, which would have counted him out, Merlin reappeared in a bed of nettles, mopping his brow. He had been standing among them as a nettle. The Orlay saw no reason to change its shape. It rushed upon the man before it with another piercing scream. Merlin vanished again, just as the thrashing trunk descended, and all stood still a moment, looking about them, wondering where he would step out next. "One," began Hecate again, but even as she proceeded with her counting, strange things began to happen. The Orlay got hiccups, turned red, swelled visibly, began whooping, came out in spots, staggered three times, rolled its eyes, fell rumbling to the ground. It groaned, kicked, and said farewell. The wart cheered, Archimedes hooted till he cried, the gorecrow fell down dead, and Hecate, on the top of her ladder, clapped so much that she nearly tumbled off. It was a masterstroke. The ingenious magician had turned himself successively into the microbes, not yet discovered, of hiccups, scarlet fever, mumps, whooping cough, measles and heat spots, and from a complication of all these complaints, the infamous Madam Mim had immediately expired. Chapter 7 Tilting and horsemanship had two afternoons a week, because they were the most important branches of a gentleman's education in those days. Merlin grumbled about athletics, saying that nowadays people seemed to think that you were an educated man if you could knock another man off a horse, and that the craze for games was the ruin of scholarship. Nobody got scholarships like they used to do when he was a boy, and all the public schools had been forced to lower their standards. But Sir Ector, who was an old tilting blue, said that the Battle of Crecy had been won upon the playing fields of Camelot. This made Merlin so furious that he gave Sir Ector rheumatism two nights running before he relented. Tilting was a great art, and needed practice. When two knights jousted, they held their lances in their right hands, but they directed their horses at one another so that each man had his opponent on his near side. The base of the lance, in fact, was held on the opposite side of the body to the side at which the enemy was charging. This seems rather inside out to anybody who is in the habit, say, of opening gates with a hunting crop, but it had its reasons. For one thing, it meant that the shield was on the left arm, so that the opponents charged shield to shield, fully covered. It also meant that a man could be unhorsed with the side or edge of the lance in a kind of horizontal swipe if you did not feel sure of hitting him with your point. This was the humblest or least skilful blow in jousting. A good jouster, like Lancelot or Tristram, always used the blow of the point, because, although it was liable to miss in unskilful hands, it made contact sooner. If one knight charged with his lance held rigidly sideways to sweep his opponent out of the saddle, the other knight, with his lance held directly forward, would knock him down a lance length before the sweep came into effect. Then there was how to hold the lance for the point stroke. It was no good crouching in the saddle and clutching it in a rigid grip preparatory to the great shock. For if you held it inflexibly like this, its point bucked up and down to every movement of your thundering mount, and you were practically certain to miss the aim. On the contrary, you had to sit loosely in the saddle, with the lance easy and balanced against the horse's motion. It was not until the actual moment of striking that you clamped your knees into the horse's sides, threw your weight forward in your seat, clutched the lance with the whole hand instead of with the finger and thumb, and hugged your right elbow to your side to support the butt. There was the size of the spear. Obviously a man with a spear 100 yards long would strike down an opponent with a spear of 10 or 12 feet before the latter came anywhere near him. But it would have been impossible to make a spear 100 yards long, and if made, impossible to carry it. The jouster had to find out the greatest length which he could manage with the greatest speed, and he had to stick to that. Sir Lancelot, who came some time after this part of the story, had several sizes of spear, and would call for his great spear or his lesser spear, as occasion demanded. There were the places on which the enemy should be hit. In the armoury of the Castle of the Forest Sauvage, there was a big picture of a knight in armour, with circles round his vulnerable points. These varied with the style of armour, so that you had to study your opponent before the charge and select a point. The good armourers, the best lived in Warrington and still live near there, were careful to make all the forward or entering sides of their suits convex, so that the spear point glanced off them. Curiously enough, the shields of Gothic suits were more inclined to be concave. It was better that a spear point should stay on the shield rather than glance off upward or downward and perhaps hit a more vulnerable point of the body armour. The best place of all for hitting people was on the very crest of the tilting helm. That is, if the person in question were vain enough to have a large metal crest in whose folds and ornaments the point would find a ready lodging. Many were vain enough to have these armorial crests with bears and dragons, or even ships or castles on them, but Sir Lancelot always contented himself with a bear helmet, or a bunch of feathers which would not hold spears, or, on one occasion, a soft lady's sleeve. It would take too long to go into all the interesting details of proper tilting which the boys had to learn, for in those days you had to be a master of your craft from the bottom upward. You had to know what wood was best for spears and why, and even how to turn them so that they would not splinter or warp. There were a thousand disputed questions about arms and armour, all of which had to be understood. Just outside Sir Ector's castle, there was a jousting field for tournaments, although there had been no tournaments in it since Kay was born. It was a green meadow, kept short, with a broad grassy bank raised round it, on which pavilions could be erected. There was an old wooden grandstand at one side, lifted on stilts for the ladies. At present the field was only used as a practice ground for tilting, so a quintain had been erected at one end and a ring at the other. The quintain was a wooden Saracen on a pole. He was painted with a bright blue face and red beard and glaring eyes. He had a shield in his left hand and a flat wooden sword in his right. If you hit him in the middle of his forehead, all was well. But if your lance struck him on the shield, or on any part to left or right of the middle line, then he spun round with great rapidity, and usually caught you a wallop with his sword as you galloped by, ducking. His paint was somewhat scratched, and the wood picked up over his right eye. The ring was just an ordinary iron ring tied to a kind of gallows by a thread. If you managed to put your point through the ring, the thread broke, and you could canter off proudly with the ring round your spear. The day was cooler than it had been for some time, for the autumn was almost within sight, and the two boys were in the tilting yard with the master armourer and Merlin. The master armourer, or sergeant-at-arms, was a stiff, pale, bouncy gentleman with waxed moustaches. He always marched about with his chest stuck out like a pouter pigeon, and he called out, "On the word, one!" on every possible occasion. He took great pains to keep his stomach in, and often tripped over his feet because he couldn't see them over his chest. He was generally making his muscles ripple, which annoyed Merlin. Wart lay beside Merlin in the shade of the grandstand and scratched himself for harvest bugs. The saw-like sickles had only lately been put away, and the wheat stood in stooks of eight among the tall stubble of those times. The wart still itched. He was also sore about the shoulders and had a burning ear from making Boche shots at the quintain, for of course practice tilting was done without armour. Wart was pleased that it was Kay's turn to go through it now, and he lay drowsily in the shade, snoozing, scratching, twitching like a dog, and partly attending to the fun. Merlin, sitting with his back to all the athleticism, was practising a spell which he had forgotten. It was a spell to make the sergeant's moustaches uncurl, but at present it only uncurled one of them, and the sergeant had not noticed it. He absent-mindedly curled it up again every time Merlin did the spell, and Merlin said, "Drat it," and began again. Once he made the sergeant's ears flap by mistake, and the latter gave a startled look at the sky. From far off at the other side of the tilting ground, the sergeant's voice came floating on the still air.
"Nah, nah, Master Kay, that ain't it at all. As you were, as you were. The spear should be held between the thumb and forefinger of the right hand, with the shield in line with the seam of the trouser leg."
The wart rubbed his sore ear and sighed.
"What are you grieving about?"
"I was not grieving. I was thinking."
"What were you thinking?"
"Oh, it was not anything. I was thinking about Kay learning to be a knight."
"And well you may grieve," exclaimed Merlin hotly. "A lot of brainless unicorns swaggering about and calling themselves educated just because they can push each other off a horse with a bit of stick. It makes me tired. Why, I believe Sir Ector would have been gladder to get a by-a-lady tilting blue for your tutor that swings himself along on his knuckles like an anthropoid ape, rather than a magician of known probity and international reputation with first-class honours from every European university. The trouble with the Norman aristocracy is that their game's mad. That is what it is. Game's mad."
He broke off indignantly and deliberately made the sergeant's ears flap slowly twice in unison. "I was not thinking quite about that," said the wart. "As a matter of fact, I was thinking how nice it would be to be a knight like Kay."
"Well, you will be one soon enough, won't you?" asked the old man impatiently.
Wart did not answer.
"Won't you?"
Merlin turned round and looked closely at the boy through his spectacles.
"What is the matter now?" he inquired nastily.
His inspection had shown him that his pupil was trying not to cry, and if he spoke in a kind voice, he would break down and do it.
"I shall not be a knight," replied the wart coldly.
Merlin's trick had worked, and he no longer wanted to weep. He wanted to kick Merlin.
"I shall not be a knight because I am not a proper son of Sir Ector's. They will knight Kay, and I shall be his squire."
Merlin's back was turned again, but his eyes were bright behind his spectacles.
"Too bad," he said without commiseration.
The wart burst out with all his thoughts aloud.
"Oh," he cried, "but I should have liked to be born with a proper father and mother, so that I could be a knight-errant."
"What would you have done?"
"I should have had a splendid suit of armour, and dozens of spears, and a black horse standing 18 hands, and I should have called myself the Black Knight, and I should have hoved at a well or a ford or something, and made all true knights that came that way to joust with me for the honour of their ladies, and I should have spared them all after I'd given them a great fall. And I should live out of doors all the year round in a pavilion, and never do anything but joust and go on quests, and bear away the prize at tournaments, and I should not ever tell anybody my name."
"Your wife will scarcely enjoy the life."
"Oh, I'm not going to have a wife. I think they're stupid. I shall have to have a lady love, though," added the future knight uncomfortably, "so that I can wear her favour in my helm, and do deeds in her honour."
A humble bee came zooming between them, under the grandstand and out into the sunlight.
"Would you like to see some real knights errant?" asked the magician slowly. "Now, for the sake of your education."
"Oh, I would. We've never even had a tournament since I was here."
"I suppose it could be managed."
"Oh, please do. You could take me to some like you did to the fish."
"I suppose it is educational, in a way."
"It is very educational," said the wart. "I can't think of anything more educational than to see some real knights fighting. Oh, won't you please do it?"
"Do you prefer any particular knight?"
"King Pellinore," he said immediately. He had a weakness for this gentleman since their strange encounter in the forest.
Merlin said,
"That will do very well. Put your hands to your sides and relax your muscles. Cabricius archi turum, catalamus singulariter nominativa haec musa. Shut your eyes and keep them shut. Bonus bona bonum. Here we go. Deus sanctus est ne oratio latinas, etiam vi quare, pourquoi, Quae substantivo et adjectivum concordat in generi numerum et casus. Here we are.
While this incantation was going on, the patient felt some queer sensations. First he could hear the sergeant calling out to Kay,
now then, keep the heel stand and swing the body from the hips.
Then the words got smaller and smaller, as if he were looking at his feet through the wrong end of a telescope, and began to swirl around in a cone, as if they were at the pointed bottom end of a whirlpool which was sucking him into the air. Then there was nothing but a loud rotating, roaring and hissing noise, which rose to such a tornado that he felt that he could not stand it any more. Finally, there was utter silence, and Merlin saying,
"Here we are."
All this happened in about the time that it would take a sixpenny rocket to start off with its fiery swish, bend down from its climax, and disperse itself in thunder and coloured stars. He opened his eyes just at the moment when one would have heard the invisible stick hitting the ground. They were lying under a beech tree in the Forest Sauvage.
"Here we are," said Merlin. "Get up and dust your clothes." "And there, I think," continued the magician, in a tone of satisfaction because his spells had worked for once without a hitch, "is your friend King Pellinore, pricking toward us o'er the plain."
"Hello, hello!" cried King Pellinore, popping his visor up and down. "It's the young boy with the feather bed, isn't it, I say, what?"
"Yes, it is," said the wart, "and I'm very glad to see you. Did you manage to catch the beast?"
"No," said King Pellinore, "didn't catch the beast. Oh, do come here, you brachet, and leave that bush alone. Cha, cha, naughty, naughty. She runs riot, you know what. Very keen on rabbits. I tell you there's nothing in it, you beastly dog. Cha, cha, leave it, leave it. Oh, do come to heel, like I tell you. She never does come to heel," he added.
At this the dog put a cock pheasant out of the bush, which rocketed off with a tremendous clatter, and the dog became so excited that it ran round its master three or four times at the end of its rope, panting hoarsely as if it had asthma. King Pellinore's horse stood patiently while the rope was wound round its legs, and Merlin and the wart had to catch the brachet and unwind it before the conversation could go on.
"I say," said King Pellinore, "thank you very much, I must say. Won't you introduce me to your friend, what?"
"This is my tutor, Merlin, a great magician."
"How do you do?" said the king. "Always like to meet magicians. In fact, I always like to meet anybody. It passes the time away, what, on a quest?"
"Hail," said Merlin, in his most mysterious manner.
"Hail,"
replied the king, anxious to make a good impression. They shook hands.
"Did you say hail?" inquired the king, looking about him nervously. "I thought it was going to be fine myself."
"He meant, how do you do?" explained the wart.
"Ah, yes, how do you do?"
They shook hands again.
"Good afternoon," said King Pellinore. "What do you think the weather looks like now?"
"I think it looks like an anti-cyclone."
"Ah, yes," said the king, "an anti-cyclone. Well, I suppose I ought to be getting along."
At this the king trembled very much, opened and shut his visor several times, coughed, wove his reins into a knot, exclaimed,
"I beg your pardon,"
and showed signs of cantering away.
"He is a white magician," said the wart. "You need not be afraid of him. He is my best friend, Your Majesty, and in any case he generally gets his spells muddled up."
"Ah, yes," said King Pellinore. "A white magician, what? How small the world is it not? How do you do?"
"Hail," said Merlin.
"Hail,"
said King Pellinore. They shook hands for the third time.
"I should not go away," said the wizard, "if I were you. Sir Grummore Grummersome is on the way to challenge you to a joust."
"No, you don't say. Sir what-you-may-call-it, come in here to challenge me to a joust?"
"Assuredly."
"Good handicap, man?"
"I should think it would be an even match."
"Well, I must say," exclaimed the king, "it never hails, but it pours."
"Hail," said Merlin.
"Hail," said King Pellinore.
"Hail," said the wart.
"Now I really won't shake hands with anybody else," announced the monarch. "We must assume that we have all met before."
"Is Sir Grummore really coming?" inquired the wart, hastily changing the subject, "to challenge King Pellinore to a battle?"
"Look yonder," said Merlin, and both of them looked in the direction of his outstretched finger. Sir Grummore Grummorsome was cantering up the clearing in full panoply of war. Instead of his ordinary helmet with a visor, he was wearing the proper tilting helm, which looked like a large coal scuttle, and as he cantered he clanged. He was singing his old school song.
"We'll tilt together, steady from crupper to poll, and nothing in life shall sever our love for the dear old call. Follow up, follow up, follow up, follow up, follow up, till the shield ring again and again with the clanks of the clanky true men."
"Goodness," exclaimed King Pellinore, "it's about 2 months since I had a proper tilt, and last winter they put me up to 18. That was when they had the new handicaps."
Sir Grummore had arrived while he was speaking, and had recognised the wart.
"Morning," said Sir Grummore. "You're Sir Ector's boy, ain't you? And who's that chap in the comic hat?"
"That is my tutor," said the wart hurriedly. "Merlin, the magician." Sir Grummore looked at Merlin. Magicians were considered rather middle-class by the true jousting set in those days, and said distantly,
"Ah, a magician, how do you do?"
"And this is King Pellinore," said the wart. "Sir Grummore Grummorsome, King Pellinore."
"How do you do?" inquired Sir Grummore.
"Hail," said King Pellinore. "No, I mean it won't hail, will it?"
"Nice day," said Sir Grummore.
"Yes, it is nice, isn't it? What?"
"Been questing today?"
"Oh, yes, thank you. Always am questing, you know, after the questing beast."
"Interesting job, that, very."
"Yes, it is interesting. Would you like to see some fumets?"
"By Jove, yes. Like to see some fumets."
"I have some better ones at home, but these are quite good, really."
"Bless my soul. So these are her fumets?"
"Yes, these are her fumets."
"Interesting fumets."
"Yes, they are interesting, aren't they? Only you get tired of them," added King Pellinore.
"Well, well, it's a fine day, isn't it?"
"Yes, it is rather fine."
"Suppose we better have a joust, eh, what?"
"Yes, I suppose we had better," said King Pellinore, "really."
"What shall we have it for?"
"Oh, the usual, I suppose. Would one of you kindly help me on with my helm?"
They all three had to help him on eventually, for what with the unscrewing of screws and the easing of nuts and bolts, which the king had clumsily set on the wrong thread when getting up in a hurry that morning, it was quite a feat of engineering to get him out of his helmet and into his helm. The helm was an enormous thing, like an oil drum, padded inside with 2 thicknesses of leather and 3 inches of straw. As soon as they were ready, the 2 knights stationed themselves at each end of the clearing and then advanced to meet in the middle.
"Fair knight," said King Pellinore, "I pray tell me thy name."
"That me regards," replied Sir Grummore, using the proper formula.
"That is uncourteously said," said King Pellinore. "What? For no knight ne dreadeth for to speak his name openly, but for some reason of shame."
"Be that as it may, I choose that thou shalt not know my name, as at this time for no asking."
"Then you must stay and joust with me, false knight."
"Haven't you got that wrong, Pellinore?" inquired Sir Grummore. "I believe it ought to be, thou shalt."
"Oh, I'm sorry, Sir Grummore. Yes, so it should, of course. Then thou shalt stay and joust with me, false knight."
Without further words, the gentlemen retreated to the opposite ends of the clearing,
feutered their spears and prepared to hurtle together in the preliminary charge.
"I think we had better climb this tree," said Merlin. "You never know what will happen in a joust like this."
They climbed up the big beech, which had easy branches sticking out in all directions, and the wart stationed himself toward the end of a smooth bough about 15 feet up, where he could get a good view. Nothing is so comfortable to sit in as a beech. To be able to picture the terrible battle which now took place, there is one thing which ought to be known. A knight in his full armour of those days, or at any rate during the heaviest days of armour, was generally carrying as much or more than his own weight in metal. He often weighed no less than 22 stone, and sometimes as much as 25. This meant that his horse had to be a slow and enormous weight carrier, like the farm horse of today, and that his own movements were so hampered by his burden of iron and padding that they were toned down into slow motion, as on the cinema.
"They're off!" cried the wart, holding his breath with excitement.
Slowly and majestically the ponderous horses lumbered into a walk. The spears, which had been pointing in the air, bowed to a horizontal line and pointed at each other. King Pellinore and Sir Grummor could be seen to be thumping their horses' sides with their heels for all they were worth, and in a few minutes the splendid animals had shambled into an earth-shaking imitation of a trot. Clank, rumble, thump, thump went the horses, and now the two knights were flapping their elbows and legs in unison, showing a good deal of daylight at their seats. There was a change in tempo, and Sir Grummor's horse could be definitely seen to be cantering. In another minute King Pellinore's was doing so too. It was a terrible spectacle.
"Oh, dear!" exclaimed the wart, feeling ashamed that his bloodthirstiness had been responsible for making these two knights joust before him. "Do you think they will kill each other?"
"Dangerous sport," said Merlin, shaking his head.
"Now!" cried the wart.
With a blood-curdling beat of iron hooves, the mighty equestrians came together. Their spears wavered for a moment within a few inches of each other's helms. Each had chosen the difficult point-stroke, and then they were galloping off in opposite directions. Sir Grummor drove his spear deep into the beech tree where they were sitting and stopped dead. King Pellinore, who had been run away with, vanished altogether behind his back.
"Is it safe to look?" inquired the wart, who had shut his eyes at the critical moment.
"Quite safe," said Merlin. "It will take them some time to get back in position."
"Woe! Woe, I say!"
cried King Pellinore in muffled and distant tones, far away among the gorse bushes.
"Hi, Pellinore, hi!" shouted Sir Grummor. "Come back, my dear fella. I'm over here."
There was a long pause, while the complicated stations of the two knights readjusted themselves, and then King Pellinore was at the opposite end from that at which he had started, while Sir Grummor faced him from his original position.
"Traitor knight!" cried Sir Grummor.
"Yield, recreant, what?"
cried King Pellinore. They feutered their spears again and thundered into the charge.
"Oh," said the wart, "I hope they don't hurt themselves."
But the two mounts were patiently blundering together, and the two knights had simultaneously decided on the sweeping stroke. Each held his spear at right angles toward the left, and before the wart could say anything further, there was a terrific yet melodious thump.
Clang went the armour,
like a motor omnibus in collision with a smithy, and the jousters were sitting side by side on the green sward, while their horses cantered off in opposite directions.
"A splendid fall," said Merlin.
The two horses pulled themselves up, their duty done, and began resignedly to eat the sward. King Pellinore and Sir Grummor sat looking straight before them, each with the other's spear clasped hopefully under his arm.
"Well," said the wart, "what a bump! They both seem to be all right so far."
Sir Grummor and King Pellinore laboriously got up.
"Defend thee!" cried King Pellinore.
"God save thee!" cried Sir Grummor.
With this they drew their swords and rushed together with such ferocity that each, after dealing the other a dent on the helm, sat down suddenly backwards.
"Bah!" cried King Pellinore.
"Boo!"
cried Sir Grummore, also sitting down.
"Mercy!" exclaimed the wart. "What a combat!"
The knights had now lost their tempers, and the battle was joined in earnest. It did not matter much, however, for they were so encased in metal that they could not do each other much damage. It took them so long to get up, and the dealing of a blow when you weighed the eighth part of a ton was such a cumbrous business that every stage of the contest could be marked and pondered. In the first stage, King Pellinore and Sir Grummore stood opposite each other for about half an hour and walloped each other on the helm. There was only opportunity for one blow at a time, so they more or less took it in turns, King Pellinore striking while Sir Grummore was recovering and vice versa. At first, if either of them dropped his sword or got it stuck in the ground, the other put in two or three extra blows while he was patiently fumbling for it or trying to tug it out. Later, they fell into the rhythm of the thing more perfectly, like the toy mechanical people who saw wood on Christmas trees. Eventually, the exercise and the monotony restored their good humour, and they began to get bored. The second stage was introduced as a change by common consent. Sir Grummore stumped off to one end of the clearing, while King Pellinore plodded off to the other. Then they turned round and swayed backward and forward once or twice, in order to get their weight on their toes. When they leaned forward, they had to run forward to keep up with their weight, and if they leaned too far backward, they fell down. So even walking was complicated. When they'd got their weight properly distributed in front of them, so that they were just off their balance, each broke into a trot to keep up with himself. They hurtled together as it had been two boars. They met in the middle, breast to breast, with a noise of shipwreck and great bells tolling, and both, bouncing off, fell breathless on their backs. They lay thus for a few minutes panting. Then they slowly began to heave themselves to their feet, and it was obvious that they had lost their tempers once again. King Pellinore had not only lost his temper, but he seemed to have been a bit astonished by the impact. He got up, facing the wrong way, and could not find Sir Grummore. There was some excuse for this, since he had only a slit to peep through, and that was 3 inches away from his eye, owing to the padding of straw, but he looked muddled as well. Perhaps he had broken his spectacles. Sir Grummore was quick to seize advantage. "Take that!" cried Sir Grummore, giving the unfortunate monarch a two-handed swipe on the knob as he was slowly turning his head from side to side, peering in the opposite direction. King Pellinore turned round morosely, but his opponent had been too quick for him. He had ambled round so that he was still behind the king, and now gave him another terrific blow in the same place.
"Where are you?"
asked King Pellinore.
"Here!"
cried Sir Grummore, giving him another. The poor king turned himself round as nimbly as possible, but Sir Grummore had given him the slip again.
"Tally-ho, back!" shouted Sir Grummore, with another wallop.
"I think you're a cad!"
said the king.
"Wallop!"
replied Sir Grummore, doing it. What with the preliminary crash, the repeated blows on the back of his head, and the puzzling nature of his opponent, King Pellinore could now be seen to be visibly troubled in his brains. He swayed backward and forward under the hail of blows which were administered, and feebly wagged his arms.
"Poor king," said the wart, "I wish he would not hit him so."
As if in answer to his wish, Sir Grummore paused in his labours.
"Do you want packs?"
asked Sir Grummore. King Pellinore made no answer. Sir Grummore favoured him with another whack and said,
"If you don't say pax, I shall cut your head off."
"I won't,"
said the king. Whang! Went the sword on top of his head. Whang! It went again. Whang! For the third time.
"Pax,"
said King Pellinore, mumbling rather. Then, just as Sir Grummore was relaxing with the fruits of his victory, he swung round upon him, shouted, "None!" at the top of his voice, and gave him a good push in the middle of the chest.
Sir Grammor fell over backwards. "Well," exclaimed the wart, "what a cheat! I would not have thought it of him." King Pellinor hurriedly sat on his victim's chest, thus increasing the weight upon him to a quarter of a ton and making it quite impossible for him to move, and began to undo Sir Grammor's helm.
"You said pax."
"I said pax non, under my breath."
"It's a swindle."
"It's not."
"You're a cad."
"No, I'm not."
"Yes, you are."
"No, I'm not."
"Yes, you are."
"I said pax non."
"You said pax."
"No, I didn't."
"Yes, you did."
"No, I didn't."
"Yes, you did."
By this time Sir Grammor's helm was unlaced, and they could see his bare head glaring at King Pellinore, quite purple in the face.
"Yield thee, recreant," said the king.
"Shan't," said Sir Grammor.
"You have got to yield, or I shall cut off your head."
"Cut it off, then."
"Oh, come on," said the king. "You know you have to yield when your helm is off."
"Fain I," said Sir Grammor.
"Well, I shall just cut your head off."
"I don't care."
The king waved his sword menacingly in the air.
"Go on," said Sir Grammor. "I dare you to."
The king lowered his sword and said,
"Oh, I say, do yield, please."
"You yield," said Sir Grammor.
"But I can't yield. I am on top of you after all, am I not, what?"
"Well, I have feigned yielding."
"Oh, come on, Grammor. I do think you are a cad not to yield. You know very well I can't cut your head off."
"I would not yield to a cheat who started fighting after he said pax."
"I am not a cheat."
"You are a cheat."
"No, I'm not."
"Yes, you are."
"No, I am not."
"Yes, you are."
"Very well," said King Pellinore. "You can jolly well get up and put on your helm and we will have a fight. I won't be called a cheat for anybody."
"Cheat,"
said Sir Grammor. They stood up and fumbled together with the helm, hissing, "No, I'm not. Yes, you are," until it was safely on. Then they retreated to opposite ends of the clearing, got their weight upon their toes, and came rumbling and thundering together like two runaway trams. Unfortunately, they were now so cross that they had both ceased to be vigilant, and in the fury of the moment they missed each other altogether. The momentum of their armour was too great for them to stop till they had passed each other handsomely, and then they manoeuvred about in such a manner that neither happened to come within the other's range of vision. It was funny watching them, because King Pellinore, having already been caught from behind once, was continually spinning round to look behind him, and Sir Grammor, having used the stratagem himself, was doing the same thing. Thus they wandered for some 5 minutes, standing still, listening, clanking, crouching, creeping, peering, walking on tiptoe, and occasionally making a chance swipe behind their backs. Once they were standing within a few feet of each other, back to back, only to stalk off in opposite directions with infinite precaution. And once King Pellinore did hit Sir Grammor with one of his backstrokes, but they both immediately spun round so often that they became giddy and mislaid each other afresh. After 5 minutes, Sir Grammor said,
"All right, Pellinore, it's no use hiding. I can see where you are."
"I am not hiding," exclaimed King Pellinore indignantly. "Where am I?"
They discovered each other and went up close together, face to face.
"Cad,"
said Sir Grammor.
"Yah,"
said King Pellinore. They turned round and marched off to their corners, seething with indignation.
"Swindler!"
shouted Sir Grammor.
"Beastly bully!"
shouted King Pellinore. With this they summoned all their energies together for one decisive encounter, leaned forward, lowered their heads like two billy goats, and positively sprinted together for the final blow. Alas, their aim was poor. They missed each other by about 5 yards, passed at full steam, doing at least 8 knots, like ships that pass in the night but speak not to each other in passing, and hurtled onward to their doom. Both knights began waving their arms like windmills, anti-clockwise, in the vain effort to slow up. Both continued with undiminished speed. Then Sir Grummore rammed his head against the beech in which the wart was sitting, and King Pellinore collided with a chestnut at the other end of the clearing. The trees shook, the forest rang. Blackbirds and squirrels cursed, and wood pigeons flew out of their leafy perches half a mile away. The two knights stood to attention while one could count three. Then, with a last unanimous, melodious clang, they both fell prostrate on the fatal sward.
"Stunned," said Merlin, "I should think."
"Oh, dear," said the wart. "Ought we to get down and help them?"
"We could pour water on their heads," said Merlin reflectively, "if there was any water. But I don't suppose they would thank us for making their armour rusty. They will be all right. Besides, it is time that we were home."
"But they might be dead."
"They are not dead, I know. In a minute or two they will come round and go off home to dinner."
"Poor King Pellinore has not got a home."
"Then Sir Grummore will invite him to stay the night. They will be the best of friends when they come to. They always are."
"Do you think so?"
"My dear boy, I know so. Shut your eyes, and we will be off."
The wart gave in to Merlin's superior knowledge. "Do you think," he asked with his eyes shut, "that Sir Grummore has a feather bed?"
"Probably."
"Good," said the wart. "That will be nice for King Pellinore, even if he was stunned." The Latin words were spoken, and the secret passes made. The funnel of whistling noise and space received them. In 2 seconds, they were lying under the grandstand, and the sergeant's voice was calling from the opposite side of the tilting ground.
"Now then, Master Ort, now then, you've been a snoozing there long enough. Come out into the sunlight here with Master Kay, 1-2, 1-2, and see some real tilting."
Chapter 8. It was a cold, wet evening, such as may happen even toward the end of August, and the wart did not know how to bear himself indoors. He spent some time in the kennels talking to Caval, then wandered off to help them turn the spit in the kitchen, but there it was too hot. He was forced to stay indoors because of the rain by his female supervisors, as happens too frequently to the unhappy children of our generation. But the mere wetness and dreariness in the open discouraged him from going out. He hated everybody.
"Confound the boy," said Sir Ector. "For goodness sake, stop moping by that window there. Go and find your tutor. When I was a boy, we always used to study on wet days, yes, and educate our minds."
"Wart is stupid," said Kay.
"Ah, run along, my duck," said their old nurse. "I ain't got time to attend to the mopsies now, what with all this sorbent washing." "Now then, my young maester," said Hob, "let they run off to their quarters and stop confusing they fowls." "Nah, nah," said the sergeant. "You hop off out of here. I got enough to do a polishing of this by Lady Harmer."
Even the dog boy barked at him when he went back to the kennels. Wart dragged off to the tower room, where Merlin was busy knitting himself a woolen nightcap for the winter.
"I cast off now together at every other line," said the magician, "but for some reason it seems to end too sharply, like an onion. It's the turning of the heel that does one every time."
"I think I ought to have some education," said the wart. "I can't think of anything to do."
"You think that education is something which ought to be done when all else fails?" inquired Merlin nastily, for he was in a bad mood too.
"Well," said the wart, "some sorts of education."
"Mine?" asked the magician with flashing eyes.
"Oh, Merlin," exclaimed the wart without answering, "please give me something to do, because I feel so miserable. Nobody wants me for anything today, and I just don't know how to be sensible. It rains so."
"You should learn to knit."
"Could I go out and be something? A fish or anything like that?"
"You have been a fish," said Merlin. "Nobody with any go needs to do their education twice."
"Well, could I be a bird?"
"If you knew anything at all,"
said Merlin, "which you do not. You would know that a bird does not like to fly in the rain, because it wets its feathers and makes them stick together. They get bedraggled." "I could be a hawk in Hob's Mews," said the wart stoutly. "Then I should be indoors and not get wet."
"That is pretty ambitious," said the old man, "to want to be a hawk."
"You know you will turn me into a hawk when you want to," shouted the wart, "but you like to plague me because it is wet. I won't have it."
"Hoity-toity."
"Please," said the wart, "dear Merlin, turn me into a hawk. If you don't do that, I shall do something. I don't know what."
Merlin put down his knitting and looked at his pupil over the top of his spectacles.
"My boy," he said, "you shall be everything in the world. Animal, vegetable, mineral, protista or virus, for all I care, before I've done with you. But you will have to trust to my superior backsight. The time is not yet ripe for you to be a hawk. For one thing, Hob is still in the mews feeding them, so you may as well sit down for the moment and learn to be a human being."
"Very well," said the wart, "if that's a go." And he sat down. After several minutes, he said, "Is one allowed to speak as a human being, or does the thing about being seen and not heard have to apply?"
"Everybody can speak."
"That's good, because I wanted to mention that you have been knitting your beard into the nightcap for 3 rows now."
"Well, I'll be..."
"I should think the best thing would be to cut off the end of your beard. Shall I fetch some scissors?"
"Why didn't you tell me before?"
"I wanted to see what would happen."
"You run a grave risk, my boy," said the magician, "of being turned into a piece of bread and toasted."
With this, he slowly began to unpick his beard, muttering to himself meanwhile, and taking the greatest precaution not to drop a stitch.
"Will it be as difficult to fly," asked the wart when he thought his tutor had calmed down, "as it was to swim?"
"You will not need to fly. I don't mean to turn you into a loose hawk, but only to set you in the mews for the night, so that you can talk to the others. That is the way to learn, by listening to the experts."
"Will they talk?"
"They talk every night, deep into the darkness. They say about how they were taken, about what they can remember of their homes, about their lineage and the great deeds of their ancestors, about their training and what they've learned and will learn. It is military conversation, really, like you might have in the mess of a crack cavalry regiment. Tactics, small arms, maintenance, betting, famous hunts, wine, women and song. Another subject they have," he continued, "is food. It is a depressing thought, but of course they're mainly trained by hunger. They're a hungry lot, poor chaps, thinking of the best restaurants where they used to go, and how they had champagne and caviar and gypsy music. Of course they all come of noble blood."
"What a shame that they should be kept prisoners and be hungry."
"Well, they do not really understand that they are prisoners, any more than the cavalry officers do. They look on themselves as being dedicated to their profession, like an order of knighthood or something of that sort. You see, the membership of the mews is, after all, restricted to the raptors, and that does help a lot. They know that none of the lower classes can get in. Their screen perches don't carry blackbirds or such trash as that. And then, as to the hungry part, they're far from starving or that kind of hunger. They are in training, you know, and like everybody in strict training, they think about food."
"How soon can I begin?"
"You can begin now, if you want to. My insight tells me that Hob has this minute finished for the night. But first of all, you must choose what kind of hawk you would prefer to be."
"I should like to be a Merlin," said the wart politely.
This answer flattered the magician.
"A very good choice," he said, "and if you please, we will proceed at once."
The wart got up from his stool and stood in front of his tutor. Merlin put down his knitting.
"First you go small," said he, pressing him on the top of his head until he was a bit smaller than a pigeon. Then you stand on the ball of your toes, bend at the knees, hold your elbows to your sides, lift your hands to the level of your shoulders, and press your first and second fingers together, and also your third and fourth. Look, it is like this.
With these words, the ancient nigromant stood upon tiptoe and did as he had explained. The wart copied him carefully and wondered what would happen next. What did happen was that Merlin, who had been saying the final spells under his breath, suddenly turned himself into a condor, leaving the wart standing on tiptoe unchanged. He stood there as if he were drying himself in the sun, with a wingspread of about 11 feet, a bright orange head, and a magenta carbuncle. He looked very surprised and rather funny.
"Come back," said the wart. "You've changed the wrong one."
"It is this By Our Lady's spring cleaning," exclaimed Merlin, turning back into himself. "Once you let a woman into your study for half an hour, you do not know where to lay your hands on the right spell, not if it was ever so. Stand up, and we will try again."
This time, the now tiny wart felt his toes shooting out and scratching on the floor. He felt his heels rise and stick out behind, and his knees draw into his stomach. His thighs became quite short. A web of skin grew from his wrists to his shoulders, while his primary feathers burst out in soft quills from the end of his fingers and grew quickly. His secondaries sprouted along his forearm, and a charming little false primary sprang from the end of each thumb. The dozen feathers of his tail, with the double-deck feathers in the middle, grew out in the twinkling of an eye, and all the covert feathers of his back and breast and shoulders slipped out of the skin to hide the roots of the more important plumes. Wart looked quickly at Merlin, ducked his head between his legs and had a look through there, rattled his feathers into place, and began to scratch his chin with the sharp talon of one toe.
"Good," said Merlin. "Now, hop on my hand. Ah, be careful and don't gripe. And listen to what I have to tell you. I shall take you into the mews, now that Hob is locked up for the night, and I shall put you loose and unhooded beside Balin and Balan. Now pay attention. Don't go close to anybody without speaking first. You must remember that most of them are hooded and might be startled into doing something rash. You can trust Balin and Balan, also the kestrel and the sparhawk. Don't go within reach of the falcon unless she invites you to. On no account must you stand beside Cully's special enclosure, for he is unhooded, and he will go for you through the mesh if he gets half a chance. He's not quite right in his brains, poor chap, and if he once grips you, you will never leave his grip alive. Remember that you are visiting a kind of Spartan military mess. These fellows are regulars. As the junior subaltern, your only business is to keep your mouth shut, speak when you're spoken to, and not interrupt."
"I bet I'm more than a subaltern," said the wart, "if I am a Merlin."
"Well, as a matter of fact, you are. You will find that both the kestrel and the sparhawk will be polite to you. But for all sake's sake, don't interrupt the senior Merlins or the falcon. She is the honorary colonel of the regiment. And as for Cully, well, he is a colonel too, even if he is infantry, so you must mind your P's and Q's."
"I will be careful," said the wart, who was beginning to feel rather scared.
"Good. I shall come for you in the morning, before Hob is up."
All the hawks were silent as Merlin carried their new companion into the mews, and silent for some time afterwards when they had been left in the dark. The rain had given place to full August moonlight, so clear that you could see a woolly bear caterpillar 15 yards away out of doors as it climbed up and up the knobbly sandstone of the great keep, and it took the wart only a few moments for his eyes to become accustomed to the diffused brightness inside the mews. The darkness became watered with light, with silver radiance, and then it was an eerie sight which dawned upon his vision. Each hawk or falcon stood in the silver upon one leg, the other tucked up inside the apron of its panel, and each was a motionless statue of a knight in armour. They stood gravely in their plumed helmets, spurred and armed. The canvas or sacking screens of their perches moved heavily in a breath of wind, like banners in a chapel, and the rapt nobility of the air kept their knight's vigil in knightly patience. In those days they used to hood everything they could, even the goshawk and the merlin, which are no longer hooded according to modern practice. Wart drew his breath at the sight of all these stately figures, standing so still that they might have been cut of stone. He was overwhelmed by their magnificence, and felt no need of Merlin's warning that he was to be humble and behave himself. Presently there was a gentle ringing of a bell. The great peregrine falcon had bestirred herself, and now said, in a high nasal voice which came from her aristocratic nose,
"Gentlemen, you may converse."
There was dead silence. Only in the far corner of the room, which had been netted off for Cully, loose there, unhooded and deep in moult, they could hear a faint muttering from the choleric infantry colonel.
"Damned foreigners," he was mumbling. "Damned administration, damned politicians, damned Bolsheviks. Is this a damned dagger that I see before me, the handle toward my hand? Damned spot! Now, Cully, hast thou but one brief hour to live, and then thou must be damned perpetually?"
"Colonel," said the peregrine coldly, "not before the younger officers."
"I beg your pardon, ma'am," said the poor colonel at once. "It is something that gets into my head, you know, some deep damnation."
There was silence again, formal, terrible and calm.
"Who is the new officer?"
inquired the first fierce and beautiful voice. Nobody answered.
"Speak for yourself, sir,"
commanded the peregrine, looking straight before her as if she were talking in her sleep. They could not see him through their hoods.
"Please," began the wart, "I am a merlin."
And he stopped, scared, in the stillness. Balan, who was one of the real merlins standing beside him, leaned over and whispered quite kindly in his ear,
"Don't be afraid. Call her madam."
"I am a merlin, madam, an it please you." "A merlin? That is good. And what branch of the merlins do you stoop from?"
The wart did not know in the least what branch he stooped from, but he dared not be found out now in his lie.
"Madam," he said, "I am one of the merlins of the Forest Sauvage."
There was silence at this again, the silver silence which he had begun to fear.
"There are the Yorkshire merlins," said the honorary colonel in her slow voice at last, "and the Welsh merlins, and the Mac merlins of the north. Then there are the Salisbury ones, and several from the neighbourhood of Exmoor, and the O'Merlins of Connaught. I do not think I have heard of any family in the Forest Sauvage."
"It could be a cadet branch, madam," said Balan, "I dare say." "Bless him," thought the wart. "I shall catch him a special sparrow tomorrow and give it to him behind Hob's back."
"That will be the solution, Captain Balan, no doubt."
The silence fell again. At last the peregrine rang her bell. She said,
"We will proceed with the catechism prior to swearing him in."
The wart heard the sparhawk on his left giving nervous coughs at this, but the peregrine paid no attention.
"Merlin of the Forest Sauvage," said the peregrine, "what is a beast of the foot?"
"A beast of the foot," replied the wart, blessing his stars that Sir Ector had chosen to give him a first-rate education, "is a horse, or a hound, or a hawk."
"Why are these called beasts of the foot?"
because these beasts depend upon the powers of their feet, so that, by law, any damage to the feet of a hawk, hound, or horse is reckoned as damage to its life. A lamed horse is a murdered horse.
Good, said the peregrine. What are your most important members?
My wings, said the wart after a moment, guessing because he did not know. At this there was a simultaneous tintinnabulation of all the bells, as each graven image lowered its raised foot in distress. They stood on both feet now, disturbed.
Your what?
Called the peregrine sharply.
He said his damned wings, said Colonel Cully from his private enclosure, and damned be he who first cries, hold enough!
But even a thrush has wings,
cried the kestrel, speaking for the first time in his sharp-beaked alarm.
Think,
whispered Balan under his breath. The wart thought feverishly. A thrush had wings, tail, eyes, legs, apparently everything.
My talons! It will do, said the peregrine kindly, after one of her dreadful pauses. The answer ought to be feet, just as it is to all the other questions, but talons will do.
All the hawks, and of course we're using the term loosely, for some were hawks and some were falcons, raised their belled feet again and sat at ease.
What is the first law of the foot?
Think, said the friendly little Balan, behind his false primary. The wart thought, and thought right.
Never to let go, he said. Last question, said the peregrine. How would you, as a merlin, kill a pigeon bigger than yourself?
Wart was lucky in this one, for he had heard Hob giving a description of how Balan did it one afternoon, and he answered warily,
I should strangle her with my foot. Good, said the peregrine.
Bravo, cried the others, raising their feathers.
90%, said the sparhawk after a quick sum. That is, if you give him a half for the talons.
The devil damn me black!
Colonel, please,
Balan whispered to the wart. Colonel Cully is not quite right in his wits. It is his liver, we believe, but the kestrel says it is the constant strain of living up to her ladyship's standard. He says that her ladyship spoke to him from her full social station once, cavalry to infantry, you know, and that he just closed his eyes and got the vertigo. He has never been the same since.
Captain Balan, said the peregrine, it is rude to whisper. We will proceed to swear the new officer in. Now, Padre, if you please.
The poor sparhawk, who had been getting more and more nervous for some time, blushed deeply and began faltering out a complicated oath about varvels, jesses, and hoods.
With this varvel, the wart heard, I thee endow love, honour, and obey, till jest to us part.
But before the padre had got to the end of it, he broke down altogether and sobbed out,
Oh, please, your ladyship, I beg your pardon, but I have forgotten to keep my tirings.
Tirings are bones and things, explained Balan. And of course you have to swear on bones.
Forgotten to keep any tirings, but it is your duty to keep tirings.
I know.
What have you done with them?
The sparhawk's voice broke at the enormity of his confession.
I ate 'em,
wept the unfortunate priest. Nobody said anything. The dereliction of duty was too terrible for words. All stood on 2 feet and turned their blind heads toward the culprit. Not a word of reproach was spoken. Only, during an utter silence of 5 minutes, they could hear the incontinent priest snivelling and hiccupping to himself.
Well,
said the peregrine at last,
The initiation will have to be put off till tomorrow.
If you will excuse me, madame, said Balin, perhaps we could manage the ordeal tonight. I believe the candidate is loose, for I did not hear him being tied up.
At the mention of an ordeal, the wart trembled within himself, and privately determined that Balin should have not one feather of Balan's sparrow next day.
Thank you, Captain Balin. I was reflecting upon that subject myself.
Balin shut up.
Are you loose, candidate?
Oh, madam, yes, I am, if you please, but I do not think I want an ordeal.
The ordeal is customary. Let me see,
continued the honorary colonel reflectively.
What was the last ordeal we had? Can you remember, Captain Balin?
The ordeal, ma'am, said the friendly Merlin, was to hang by my jesses during the third watch.
If he is loose, he cannot do that.
You could strike him yourself, ma'am, said the kestrel. Judiciously, you know. Send him over to stand by Colonel Cully while we ring three times, said the other Merlin.
Oh, no,
cried the crazy colonel in an agony out of his remoter darkness.
Oh, no, your ladyship, I beg of you not to do that. I am such a damned villain, your ladyship, that I do not answer for the consequences. Spare the poor boy, your ladyship, and lead us not into temptation.
Colonel, control yourself. That ordeal will do very well.
Oh, madam, I was warned not to stand by Colonel Cully.
Warned? And by whom?
The poor wart realized that now he must choose between confessing himself a human and learning no more of their secrets, or going through with this ordeal to earn his education. He did not want to be a coward.
I will stand by the colonel, madam, he said, immediately noticing that his voice sounded insulting.
The peregrine falcon paid no attention to the tone.
It is well, she said. But first we must have a hymn. Now, Padre, if you have not eaten your hymns as well as your tirings, will you be so kind as to lead us in ancient but not modern number 23, the ordeal hymn? And you, Mr. Key, she added to the kestrel, you had better keep quiet, for you are always too high.
The hawks stood still in the moonlight, while the spar hawk counted, 1, 2, 3. Then all those curved or toothed beaks opened in their hoods to a brazen unison, and this is what they chanted. Life is blood, shed and offered. The eagle's eye can face this dree. To beasts of chase the lie is proffered. Timor mortis contorbat me. The beast of foot sings hold fast only, for flesh is bruckle and foot is slee. Strength to the strong and the lordly and lonely. Timor mortis exultat me. Shame to the slothful and woe to the weak one. Death to the dreadful who turn to flee. Blood to the tearing, the taloned, the beaked one. Timor mortis are we.
Very nice, said the peregrine. Captain Balin, I think you are a little off on the top sea. And now, candidate, you will go over and stand next to Colonel Cully's enclosure while we ring our bells thrice. On the third ring, you may move as quickly as you like.
Very good, madam, said the wart, quite fearless with resentment.
He flipped his wings and was sitting on the extreme end of the screen perch next to Cully's enclosure of string netting.
Boy, cried the colonel in an unearthly voice. Don't come near me. Don't come near. Ah, tempt not the foul fiend to his damnation.
I do not fear you, sir, said the wart. Do not vex yourself, for no harm will come to either of us.
No harm, quotha. Go before it is too late. I feel eternal longings in me.
Never fear, sir. They have only to ring three times. At this, the knights lowered their raised legs and gave them a solemn shake. The first sweet tinkling filled the room.
Madam, madam, cried the colonel in torture, have pity on a damned man of blood. Ring out the old, ring in the new. I can't hold off much longer.
Be brave, sir, said the wart softly.
Be brave, sir? Why, but two nights since, one met the Duke about midnight in a lane behind St. Mark's Church with the leg of a man upon his shoulder, and he howled fearfully.
It is nothing, said the wart.
Nothing! Said he was a wolf. Only the difference was a wolf's skin was hairy on the outside, his on the inside. Rip up my flesh and try. For quietus with a bare bodkin.
The bells rang for the second time. The wart's heart was thumping, and now the colonel was sidling toward him along the perch. Stamp, stamp, he went, striking the wood he trod on with a convulsive grip at every pace. His poor, mad, brooding eyes glared in the moonlight, shone against the persecuted darkness of his scowling brow. There was nothing cruel about him, no ignoble passion. He was terrified of the wart, not triumphing, and he must slay.
If it were done, when 'tis done, whispered the colonel, then 'twere well it were done quickly. Who would have thought the young man had so much blood in him?
Colonel, said the wart, but he held himself there.
Boy, cried the colonel, speak, stop me, mercy.
There is a cat behind you, said the wart calmly, or a pine marten, look. The colonel turned, swift as a wasp's sting, and menaced into the gloom. There was nothing. He swung his wild eyes again upon the wart, guessing the trick. Then, in the cold voice of an adder,
the bell invites me. Hear it not, Merlin, for it is a knell that summons thee to heaven or to hell.
The third bells were indeed ringing as he spoke, and Honor was allowed to move. The ordeal was over, and the wart might fly. But as he flew, quicker than any movement or flight in the world, the terrible sickles had shot out from the colonel's planted legs, not flashed out, for they moved too quickly for sight, and with a thump, with a clutch, with an apprehension, like being arrested by a big policeman, the great scimitars had fixed themselves in his retreating thumb. They fixed themselves, and fixed irrevocably. Gripe, gripe, the enormous thigh muscles tautened in two convulsions. Then the wart was 2 yards further down the screen, and Colonel Cully was standing on 1 foot with a few meshes of string netting and the wart's false primary, with its covert feathers vice-fisted in the other. 2 or 3 minor feathers drifted softly in a moonbeam toward the floor.
"Well stood!" cried Balan delightedly.
"A very gentlemanly exhibition," said the peregrine, not minding that Captain Balan had spoken before her.
"Amen," said the spar hawk.
"Brave heart," said the kestrel.
"Might we give him the triumph song?" asked Balin, relenting.
"Certainly,"
said the peregrine. And they all sang together, led by Colonel Cully at the top of his voice, all belling triumphantly in the terrible moonlight. "The mountain birds are sweeter, but the valley birds are fatter, and so we deemed it meeter to carry off the latter. We met a cowering coney and struck him through the vitals. The coney was like honey and squealed our requitals. Some struck the lark in feathers, whose puffing clouds were shed off. Some plucked the partridge's nethers, while others pulled his head off.
But Wart, the king of Merlin's, struck foot most far before us. His birds and beasts supply our feasts, and his feats our glorious chorus.
Mark my words, cried the beautiful Balan. We shall have a regular king in that young candidate. Now, boys, chorus all together for the last time.
But Wart, the king of Merlin's, struck foot most far before us. His birds and beasts supply our feasts, and his feats our glorious chorus.
Chapter 9.
Well, said the wart, as he woke up in his own bed next morning, what a horrible grand crew.
Kay sat up in bed and began scolding like a squirrel.
Where were you last night? He cried. I believe you climbed out. I shall tell my father and get you tanned. You know we're not allowed to go out after curfew. What have you been doing? I look for you everywhere. I know you climbed out.
The boys had a way of sliding down a rainwater pipe into the moat, which they could swim on secret occasions when it was necessary to be out at night, to wait for a badger, for instance, or to catch tench, which can only be taken just before dawn.
Oh, shut up, said the wart. I'm sleepy.
Kay said,
wake up, you beast! Where have you been?
I shan't tell you. He was sure that Kay would not believe the story, but only call him a liar and get angrier than ever.
If you don't tell me, I shall kill you.
You will not, then.
I will.
The wart turned over on his other side.
Beast,
said Kay. He took a fold of the wart's arm between the nails of his first finger and thumb and pinched for all he was worth. Wart kicked like a salmon which has been suddenly hooked and hit him wildly in the eye. In a trice they were out of bed, pale and indignant, looking rather like skinned rabbits, for in those days nobody wore clothes in bed, and whirling their arms like windmills in the effort to do each other mischief. Kay was older and bigger than the wart, so that he was bound to win in the end, but he was more nervous and imaginative. He could imagine the effect of each blow that was aimed at him, and this weakened his defence. Wart was only an infuriated hurricane.
"Leave me alone, can't you?"
And all the while he did not leave Kay alone, but with his head down and swinging arms made it impossible for Kay to do as he was bid. They punched entirely at each other's faces. Kay had a longer reach and a heavier fist. He straightened his arm, more in self-defence than in anything else, and the wart smacked his own eye upon the end of it. The sky became a noisy and shocking black, streaked outward with a blaze of meteors. The wart began to sob and pant. He managed to get in a blow upon his opponent's nose, and this began to bleed. Kay lowered his defence, turned his back on the wart, and said in a cold, snuffling, reproachful voice,
"Now it's bleeding."
The battle was over. Kay lay on the stone floor, bubbling blood out of his nose, and the wart with a black eye fetched the enormous key out of the door to put under Kay's back. Neither of them spoke. Presently, Kay turned over on his face and began to sob. He said,
"Merlin does everything for you, but he never does anything for me."
At this, the wart felt he had been a beast. He dressed himself in silence and hurried off to find the magician. On the way, he was caught by his nurse.
"Ah, you little helot," exclaimed she, shaking him by the arm. "You've been a-battling again with that there Master Kay. Look at your poor eye, I do declare. It's enough to baffle the College of Sturgeons."
"It's all right," said the wart.
"No, that isn't it, my poppet,"
cried his nurse, getting crosser and showing signs of slapping him.
"Come now, how did you do it before I have you whipped?"
"I knocked it on the bedpost," said the wart sullenly. The old nurse immediately folded him to her broad bosom, patted him on the back and said,
"There, there, my Dowsabel. It's the same story Sir Ector told me when I caught him with a blue eye gone 40 years. Nothing like a good family for sticking to a good lie. There, my innocent, you come along o' me to the kitchen and we'll slap a nice bit of steak across him in no time. But you hadn't ought to fight with people bigger than yourself."
"It's all right," said the wart again, disgusted by the fuss.
But fate was bent on punishing him, and the old lady was inexorable. It took him half an hour to escape, and then only at the price of carrying with him a juicy piece of raw beef which he was supposed to hold over his eye.
"Nothing like a mealy rump for drawing out the humours," his nurse had said, and the cook had answered,
"Us aren't seen a sweeter bit of raw since Easter, no, nor a bloodier."
"I will keep the foul thing for Balan," thought the wart, resuming his search for his tutor. He found him without trouble in the tower room which he had chosen when he arrived. All philosophers prefer to live in towers, as may be seen by visiting the room which Erasmus chose in his college at Cambridge. But Merlin's tower was even more beautiful than this. It was the highest room in the castle, directly below the lookout of the great keep, and from its window you could gaze across the open field, with its rights of warren, across the park and the chase, until your eye finally wandered out over the distant blue treetops of the Forest Sauvage. This sea of leafy timber rolled away and away in knobs like the surface of porridge, until it was finally lost in remote mountains, which nobody had ever visited, and the cloud-capped towers and gorgeous palaces of heaven. Merlin's comments upon this black eye were of a medical nature.
"The discoloration," he said, "is caused by hemorrhage into the tissues, ecchymosis, and passes from dark purple through green to yellow before it disappears."
There seemed to be no sensible reply to this.
"I suppose you had it," continued Merlin, "fighting with Kay."
"Yes. How did you know?"
"Ah, well, there it is."
"I came to ask you about Kay."
"Speak, demand. I'll answer."
"Well, Kay thinks it is unfair that you are always turning me into things and not him. I've not told him about it, but I think he guesses. I think it's unfair, too."
"It is unfair."
"So, will you turn us both next time that we are turned?" Merlin had finished his breakfast and was puffing at the meerschaum pipe, which made his pupil believe that he breathed fire. Now he took a deep puff, looked at the wart, opened his mouth to speak, changed his mind, blew out the smoke, and drew another lungful.
"Sometimes," he said, "life does seem to be unfair. Do you know the story of Elijah and the Rabbi Jachanan?"
"No," said the wart. He sat down resignedly upon the most comfortable part of the floor, perceiving that he was in for something like the parable of the looking-glass.
"This rabbi," said Merlin, "went on a journey with the prophet Elijah. They walked all day, and at nightfall they came to the humble cottage of a poor man, whose only treasure was a cow. The poor man ran out of his cottage, and his wife ran out too, to welcome the strangers for the night and to offer them all the simple hospitality which they were able to give in straitened circumstances. Elijah and the rabbi were entertained with plenty of the cow's milk, sustained by homemade bread and butter, and they were put to sleep in the best bed while their kindly hosts lay down before the kitchen fire. But in the morning, the poor man's cow was dead."
"Go on."
"They walked all the next day, and came that evening to the house of a very wealthy merchant, whose hospitality they craved. The merchant was cold and proud and rich, and all that he would do for the prophet and his companion was to lodge them in a cowshed and feed them on bread and water. In the morning, however, Elijah thanked him very much for what he had done, and sent for a mason to repair one of his walls, which happened to be falling down, as a return for his kindness. The rabbi Jachanan, unable to keep silence any longer, begged the holy man to explain the meaning of his dealings with human beings. 'In regard to the poor man who received us so hospitably,' replied the prophet, 'it was decreed that his wife was to die that night. But in reward for his goodness, God took the cow instead of his wife.
I repaired the wall of the rich miser, because a chest of gold was concealed near the place, and if the miser had repaired the wall himself, he would have discovered treasure. Say not therefore to the Lord, What dost thou? But say in thy heart, Must not the Lord of all the earth do right?
It is a nice sort of story, said the wart, because it seemed to be over.
I am sorry, said Merlin, that you should be the only one to get my extra tuition, but then, you see, I was only sent for that.
I do not see that it would do any harm for Kay to come too.
Nor do I, but the Rabbi Jacanan did not see why the miser should have had his wall repaired.
I understand that, said the wart doubtfully, but I still think it was a shame that the cow died. Could I not have Kay with me just once? Merlin said gently.
Perhaps what is good for you might be bad for him. Besides, remember, he has never asked to be turned into anything.
He wants to be turned for all that. I like Kay, you know, and I think people don't understand him. He has to be proud because he's frightened.
You still do not follow what I mean. Suppose he had gone as a Merlin last night, and failed in the ordeal, and lost his nerve.
How do you know about that ordeal?
Ah, well, there it is again.
Very well, said the wart obstinately, but suppose he had not failed in the ordeal, and had not lost his nerve. I don't see why you should have to suppose that he would have.
Oh, flout the boy! Cried the magician passionately. You don't seem to see anything this morning. What is it that you want me to do?
Turn me and Kay into snakes or something.
Merlin took off his spectacles, dashed them on the floor, and jumped on them with both feet.
Castor and Pollux, blow me to Bermuda! He exclaimed,
and immediately vanished with a frightful roar. The wart was still staring at his tutor's chair in some perplexity a few moments later when Merlin reappeared. He had lost his hat, and his hair and beard were tangled up as if by a hurricane. He sat down again, straightening his gown with trembling fingers.
"Why did you do that?" asked the wart.
"I did not do it on purpose."
"Do you mean to say that Castor and Pollux did blow you to Bermuda?"
"Let this be a lesson to you," replied Merlin, "not to swear. I think we'd better change the subject."
"We were talking about Kay."
"Yes, and what I was going to say before my visit to the still-vexed Bermuths was this. I cannot change Kay into things. The power was not deputed to me when I was sent. Why this was so, neither you nor I am able to say, but such remains the fact. I have tried to hint at some of the reasons for the fact, but you will not take them, so you must just accept the fact in its naked reality." Now, please stop talking until I've got my breath back and my hat.
The wart sat quiet while Merlin closed his eyes and began to mutter to himself. Presently, a curious black cylindrical hat appeared on his head. It was a topper. Merlin examined it with a look of disgust, said bitterly,
"And they call this service,"
and handed it back to the heir. Finally, he stood up in a passion and exclaimed,
"Come here!"
The wart and Archimedes looked at each other, wondering which was meant. Archimedes had been sitting all the while on the windowsill and looking at the view, for of course he never left his master. But Merlin did not pay them any attention.
"Now," said Merlin furiously, apparently to nobody, "do you think you're being funny? Very well, then, why do you do it? That is no excuse. Naturally, I meant the one I was wearing." "But wearing now, of course, you fool! I don't want a hat I was wearing in 1890. Have you no sense of time at all?"
Merlin took off the sailor hat, which had just appeared, and held it out to the heir for inspection.
"This is an anachronism," he said severely. "That's what it is, a beastly anachronism."
Archimedes seemed to be accustomed to these scenes, for he now said in a reasonable voice,
"Why don't you ask for the hat by name, Master? Say, 'I want my magician's hat,' not 'I want the hat I was wearing.' Perhaps the poor chap finds it as difficult to live backwards as you do."
"I want my magician's hat," said Merlin sulkily.
Instantly, the long, pointed cone was standing on his head. The tension in the air relaxed. Wart sat down again on the floor, and Archimedes resumed his toilet, passing his pinions and tail feathers through his beak to smooth the barbs together. Each barb had hundreds of little hooks or barbules on it, by means of which the barbs of the feather were held together. He was stroking them into place. Merlin said,
"I beg your pardon. I am not having a very good day today, and there it is."
"About Kay," said the wart, "even if you can't change him into things, could you not give us both an adventure without changing?"
Merlin made a visible effort to control his temper and to consider this question dispassionately. He was sick of the subject altogether.
"I cannot do any magic for Kay," he said slowly, "except my own magic that I have anyway. Backsight and insight and all that. Do you mean anything I could do with that?"
"What does your backsight do?"
"It tells me what you would say is going to happen, and the insight sometimes says what is or was happening in other places."
"Is there anything happening just now? Anything that Kay and I could go to see?"
Merlin immediately struck himself on the brow and exclaimed excitedly,
"Now I see it all. Yes, of course there is, and you are going to see it. Yes, you must take Kay and hurry up about it. You must go immediately after Mass. Have breakfast first and go immediately after Mass. Yes, that is it. Go straight to Hobb's strip of barley in the open field and follow that line until you come to something. That will be splendid, yes, and I shall have a nap this afternoon instead of those filthy Samueli logicales. Or have I had the nap?"
"You have not had it," said Archimedes. "That is still in the future, Master."
"Splendid, splendid. And mind, Wart, don't forget to take Kay with you, so that I can have my nap."
"What shall we see?" asked the Wart.
"Ah, don't plague me about a little thing like that. You run along now, there's a good boy, and mind you don't forget to take Kay with you. Why ever didn't you mention it before? Don't forget to follow beyond the strip of barley. Well, 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 this is the first half-holiday I have had since I started this confounded tutorship. First, I think I shall have a little nap before luncheon. And then I think I shall have a little nap before tea. Then I shall have to think of something I can do before dinner. What shall I do before dinner, Archimedes?"
"Have a little nap, I expect," said the owl coldly, turning his back upon his master, because he, as well as the wart, enjoyed to see life.
Chapter 10. Wart knew that if he told the elder boy about his conversation with Merlin, Kay would refuse to be condescended to and would not come. So he said nothing. It was strange, but their battle had made them friends again, and each could look the other in the eye with a kind of confused affection. They went together unanimously, though shyly, without explanations, and found themselves standing at the end of Hobb's barley strip after Mass. The wart had no need to use ingenuity. When they were there, it was easy. "Come on," he said. "Merlin told me to tell you that there was something along here that was specially for you."
"What sort of thing?" asked Kay.
"An adventure."
"How do we get to it?"
"We ought to follow the line which this strip makes, and I suppose that would take us into the forest. We should have to keep the sun just there on our left, but allow for it moving."
"All right," said Kay. "What is the adventure?"
"I don't know."
They went along the strip and followed its imaginary line over the park and over the chase, keeping their eyes skinned for some miraculous happening. They wondered whether half a dozen young pheasants they started had anything curious about them, and Kay was ready to swear that one of them was white.
If it had been white, and if a black eagle had suddenly swooped down upon it from the sky, they would have known quite well that wonders were afoot, and that all they had to do was to follow the pheasant, or the eagle, until they reached the maiden in the enchanted castle. However, the pheasant was not white. At the edge of the forest, Kay said, "I suppose we shall have to go into this." Merlin said to follow the line. "Well," said Kay, "I'm not afraid. If the adventure was for me, it is bound to be a good one." They went in and were surprised to find that the going was not bad. It was about the same as a big wood might be nowadays, whereas the common forest of those times was like a jungle on the Amazon. There were no pheasant-shooting proprietors then to see that the undergrowth was thinned, and not 1/1000th part of the number of the present-day timber merchants who prune judiciously at the few remaining woods. The most of the forest sauvage was almost impenetrable, an enormous barrier of eternal trees, the dead ones fallen against the live and held to them by ivy, the living struggling up in competition with each other toward the sun which gave them life, the floor boggy through lack of drainage or tindery from old wood, so that you might suddenly tumble through a decayed tree trunk into an ant's nest, or laced with brambles and bindweed and honeysuckle, and convolvulus and teasels and the stuff which country people call sweethearts, until you would be torn to pieces in 3 yards. This part was good. Hobbs' line pointed down what seemed to be a succession of glades, shady and murmuring places in which the wild thyme was droning with bees. The insect season was past its peak, for it was really the time for wasps and fruit, but there were many fritillaries still, with tortoise shells and red admirals on the flowering mint. Wart pulled a leaf of this and munched it like chewing gum as they walked. "It is queer," he said, "but there have been people here. Look, there's a hoof mark, and it was shod." "You don't see much," said Kay, "for there is a man." Sure enough, there was a man at the end of the next glade, sitting with a wood axe by the side of a tree which he had felled. He was a queer-looking, tiny man, with a hunchback and a face like mahogany, and he was dressed in numerous pieces of old leather which he had secured about his brawny legs and arms with pieces of cord. He was eating a lump of bread and sheep's milk cheese with a knife, which years of sharpening had worn into a mere streak, leaning his back against one of the highest trees they had ever seen. The white flakes of wood lay all about him. The dressed stump of the felled tree looked very new. His eyes were bright like a fox's. "I expect he will be the adventure," whispered Wart. "Pooh," said Kay. "You have knights in armour or dragons or things like that in an adventure, not dirty old men cutting wood." "Well, I'm going to ask him what happens along here anyway." They went up to the small munching woodman, who did not seem to have seen them, and asked him where the glades were leading to. They asked 2 or 3 times before they discovered that the poor fellow was either deaf or mad or both. He neither answered nor moved. "Oh, come on," said Kay. "He's probably loopy like Watt and does not know what he's at. Let's go on and leave the old fool." They went on for nearly a mile, and still the going was good. There were no paths exactly, and the glades were not continuous. Anybody who came there by chance would have thought that there was just the one glade which he was in, a couple of 100 yards long, unless he went to the end of it and discovered another one, screened by a few trees. Now and then they found a stump with the marks of an axe on it, but mostly these had been carefully covered with brambles or altogether grubbed up. The wart considered that the glades must have been made. Kay caught the wart by the arm at the edge of a clearing and pointed silently toward its further end. There was a grassy bank there, swelling gently to a gigantic sycamore upward of 90 feet high, which stood upon its top. On the bank there was an equally gigantic man lying at his ease, with a dog beside him. This man was as notable as the sycamore, for he stood, or lay, 7 feet without his shoes, and he was dressed in nothing but a kind of kilt made of Lincoln green worsted. He had a leather bracer on his left forearm. His enormous brown chest supported the dog's head. It had pricked its ears and was watching the boys, but had made no other movement, which the muscles gently lifted as they rose and fell. The man appeared to be asleep. There was a 7-foot bow beside him, with some arrows more than a cloth yard long. He, like the woodman, was the colour of mahogany, and the curled hairs on his chest made a golden haze where the sun caught them.
"He is it!" whispered Kay excitedly.
They went to the man cautiously for fear of the dog, but the dog only followed them with its eyes, keeping its chin pressed firmly to the chest of its beloved master, and giving them the least suspicion of a wag from its tail. It moved its tail without lifting it 2 inches sideways in the grass. The man opened his eyes. Obviously he had not been asleep at all. Smiled at the boys, and jerked his thumb in a direction which pointed further up the glade. Then he stopped smiling and shut his eyes. "Excuse me," said Kay, "what happens up there?" The man made no answer and kept his eyes closed, but he lifted his hand again and pointed onward with his thumb.
"He means us to go on," said Kay.
"It certainly is an adventure," said the wart. "I wonder if that dumb woodman could have climbed up the big tree he was leaning against and sent a message to this tree that we were coming. He certainly seems to have been expecting us." At this, the naked giant opened one eye and looked at Wart in some surprise. Then he opened both eyes, laughed all over his big, twinkling face, sat up, patted the dog, picked up his bow and rose to his feet.
"Very well, then, young maesters," he said, still laughing. "Us'll come along of 'ee arter all. Young heads still make the sharpest, they do say."
Kay looked at him in blank surprise. "Who are you?" he asked.
"Naylor," said the giant. "John Naylor, in the wide world it were, till us come to be man of the wood. Then 'twere John Little for some time, in the wood, like. But mostly folk does put it backer now, and calls us Little John."
"Oh," cried the wart in delight, "I have heard of you often, when they tell Saxon stories in the evenings, of you and Robin Hood."
"Not Hood," said Little John reprovingly. "That bain't the way to name un, maester, not in the wood."
"But it is Robin Hood in the stories," said Kay.
"Ah, them book-learning chaps, they don't know all. However, 'tis time us do be stepping along."
They fell in on either side of the enormous man, and had to run 1 step in 3 to keep up with him, for although he talked very slowly, he walked on his bare feet very fast. The dog trotted at heel.
"Please," asked the wart, "where are you taking us?"
"Why, to Robin Hood, seemingly. Aren't you sharp enough to guess that also, Maester Art?"
The giant gave him a sly peep out of the corner of his eye at this, for he knew that he had set the boys 2 problems at once. First, what was Robin's real name? And second, how did Little John come to know the warts? The wart fixed on the 2nd question first.
"How did you know my name?"
"Ah," said Little John, "us knowed."
"Does Robin Hood know we're coming?"
"Nay, my duck, a young scholard like thee should speak his name scholarly."
"Well, what is his name?" cried the boy, between exasperation and being out of breath from running to keep up. "You said Hood."
"So it is Hood, my duck, Robin Hood, like the Hoods you'm running through, and a grand fine name it is."
"Robin Wood?"
"Aye, Robin Hood. What else should un be, seeing as he rules em? Them free places, the Hoods, and fine places. Let thee sleep in em come summer, come winter, and hunt in em for thy commons lest thee starve.
and smell to em as they brings forward their comely bright leaves, according to order, or loses of em by the same order, backward. Let thee stand in em that thou be'st not seen, and move in em that thou be'st not heard, and warm thee with em as thou fall'st on sleep. Ah, they'm proper fine places, the woods, for a free man of hands and heart.
Kay said, But I thought all Robin Wood's men wore hose and jerkins of Lincoln green.
That us do in the winter, like, when us needs em, or with leather leggings at wood work. But here by summer, 'tis more seasonable thus for the pickets, who have naught to do save watch.
Were you a sentry, then?
Aye, and so were Wald Much, as you spoke to by the felled tree.
And I think, exclaimed Kay triumphantly, that this next big tree which we're coming to will be the stronghold of Robin Wood. They were coming to the monarch of the forest. It was a lime tree, as great as that which used to grow at Moor Park in Hertfordshire, no less than 100 feet in height and 17 feet in girth a yard above the ground. Its beech-like trunk was embellished with a beard of twigs at the bottom, and where each of the great branches had sprung from the trunk, the bark had split and was now discoloured with rainwater or sap. The bees zoomed among its bright and sticky leaves, higher and higher toward heaven, and a rope ladder disappeared among the foliage. Nobody could have climbed it without a ladder, even with irons.
"You think well, Maister Kay," said Little John, "and there be Maister Robin atween her roots."
The boys, who had been more interested in the lookout man perched in a crow's nest at the top of that swaying and whispering pride of the earth, lowered their eyes at once and clapped them on the great outlaw. He was not, as they had expected, a romantic man, or not at first, although he was nearly as tall as Little John. These two, of course, were the only people in the world who have ever shot an arrow the distance of a mile with the English longbow. He was a sinewy fellow whose body did not carry fat. He was not half naked like John, but dressed discreetly in faded green with a silvery bugle at his side. He was clean-shaven, sunburnt, nervous, gnarled like the roots of the trees, but gnarled and mature with weather and poetry rather than with age, for he was scarcely 30 years old. Eventually he lived to be 87, and attributed his long life to smelling the turpentine in the pines. At the moment he was lying on his back and looked upward, but not into the sky. Robin Wood lay happily with his head in Marian's lap. She sat between the roots of the lime tree, clad in a one-piece smock of green, girded with a quiver of arrows, and her feet and arms were bare. She had let down the brown, shining waterfalls of her hair, which was usually kept braided in pigtails for convenience in hunting and cookery, and with the falling waves of this she framed his head. She was singing a duet with him softly, and tickling the end of his nose with the fine hairs. Under the green wood tree,